Welcome into another installment of the MTOM Show podcast. I'm Paul Yeager, joined by my old friend David Paul. And David and I were talking right before we rolled. I'm working my way through the KWQC Channel 6 Davenport Weather Center. So Teresa Bryant's next, then Chris Utzman, Christina Sharoma. Although you technically didn't work at Channel 6.
No, I was WQAD.
You were QAD in Moline.
That was across the river.
David and I worked together in Mason City, Iowa, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Isn't that hard to believe?
That long? It's mind-blowing that it's been 20-some years. Doesn't feel like it.
No, you look the same, dude.
So do you, man.
I see these pictures of a muscular man, and I'm like, oh, same guy.
Going to the gym, that helps.
Well, okay, so you used to do mornings. You've done the nights. Which is better for workout-family-life balance?
I'd say nights. My mornings are free. I'm kind of spoiled. My wife gives me a hard time. Because I sleep in every day, have my coffee in the morning, relax, go to the gym, then come into work at about 2 o'clock. So my mornings are free. And then I have a dinner break. I can go home and be with the family at dinner time. And then the weekends are free. So yeah. I love the schedule. Waking up mornings, 2 o'clock in the morning, that's not so much fun. But this shift I like.
But the thing with weather is, when you're a meteorologist, weather strikes at all times of the day. Now,
yes,
the difference between where you and I used to be, where you grew up, where you've been in before versus now, the snowstorms happen in the middle of the night, but so do hurricanes. So you kind of traded the snow coverage for the hurricane coverage. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's very similar, really. Preparing for a big snowstorm is like preparing for a hurricane. You know it's coming days in advance, and then the actual event is drawn out, and you're covering it for hours or even days on end. And then, it's gone, which is good, except for the aftermath. But, we have a lot of severe weather events, and it seems like, I don't know why, the majority of those come in either on a weekend or between midnight and 3 a.m. It's like clockwork. I'm like, come on, how does it always happen at those off times? But it seems like it does.
And you have to be on the clock at those times because of your viewing area. How many counties in your viewing area there in Alabama?
We cover probably, just guessing here, probably 8 counties in southeast Alabama. We cover 3 to 4 in southwest Georgia, and then we cover the Florida Panhandle just north of Panama City. So we have about 4 counties in the Panhandle that we cover pretty closely. Our broadcast tower is actually in Florida, so our signal goes down to Destin and Panama City Beach, but that's a separate market now. But yeah, we cover a big area, and during severe weather, some of the rural areas in the Florida Panhandle, I mean, we are their source. They don't have us on cable. They have us over the air. They don't have anyone on cable. So we cover a pretty big area when it comes down to it.
And you're sitting in Dothan, Alabama today?
Dothan, Alabama. Yep. So we're far southeast Alabama, about 18 miles from Georgia and about 18, 20 miles from Florida. So tucked in the corner, not too far away from Panama City Beach, which is nice, about an hour and a half away. So a little beach weekend is always a good thing.
So, David, you grew up in Chadwick, Illinois.
Is,
I call it, it's, what was it from DeKalb? Half an hour?
From DeKalb, about an hour 10.
Okay. All right, yep. Closer to Rockford?
Yeah, between Rockford and the Quad Cities. So Carroll County, the second county down from far northwest Illinois. So Joe Davies is the most northwestern county, then just below that is Carroll County. Yeah, Chadwick's a small town, 650 people, surrounded by cornfields. And I lived on the west side of town. So when storms were coming as a kid, I'd go and I'd look over this cornfield. And I would see the weather come in. And I was like, just fascinated as a little kid by the weather all the time. And everything, of course, in the Midwest comes in from the West. So to look to the West and see these storms, it was awesome. And, I have such fond memories of growing up in a small town in farm country. It's just, maybe who I am, that hardworking Midwest attitude and that spirit. Once that's ingrained in you, you take it with you no matter where you go.
So you covered a lot of the, what we call them, the I states. You worked in Kirksville, Missouri, Mason City, Iowa, Moline, Illinois. I mean, you couldn't get much more farm country than that for the
right.
I states and the corn. What did you talk about thunderstorms. Was there any similarities to those regions? I mean, there's always that discussion of, well, there's this ridge and but those regions are the same when they come for the way fronts work. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's absolutely accurate. Yeah, Missouri, Illinois, Iowa, living there your whole life, so many of those thunderstorms in the summertime come at night. You get these big mesoscale convective complexes that develop overnight, driven by a low-level jet stream, and they can dump just a ton of rain. And then as you transition through the summertime, you get those wind events that come in from the west or northwest as you go through later in July and August. So I have so many memories of those events. I think we were both in Mason City at the time when Manly, Iowa had about 25 inches of rain. Remember that?
I just told a story about that the other day.
That was unbelievable.
10 inches overnight, and Manly is like a rock. And there was nowhere for the water to go. The system cleared out, and then Jamie Copley and I were standing on Highway 9 because it was closed right by the golf course, and another round of rain came in and basically wiped us off the air. People thought we had died because we just our signal went like that, but that's because there was a big downpour of thunderstorm that happened. Sorry.
That was unbelievable. I think that was a June event, if I remember correctly. Those summertime thunderstorm complexes are definitely mean. But yeah, that setup in the Midwest is, you know, year after year is very similar. Forecasting in the South, now I've been down South for 16 years, you know, it's a different animal compared out there. But there's nothing like those big Midwest summer thunderstorms with the wind coming in and some of the scariest weather I've ever experienced in my life. Actually, my younger brother and I, when I was in college, we were storm chasing. We were in Mount Carroll, Illinois, trying to get back to Chadwick. And we were caught underneath the awning of a gas station. And the lightning was crazy, and the rain was crazy, and it was hailing. And then when we were coming back, it's 9 miles between Mount Carroll and Chadwick. Every farmhouse, you know, you have cornfields, but every house, there's trees around the farmhouses. Trees were down. Every single house we came upon got into just before Chadwick, a great big grain bin is destroyed. And then in town, we had a cinder block building that was destroyed. I'm like, man, that was all straight line winds. That was incredible. I was scared that day. I haven't been scared many times, but that was a scary thunderstorm event back then.
And we have to show our age a little bit. You were doing that pre-cell phone. You did not have the benefits of a radar in your hand somebody else like helping you go here, go there like you can now.
Yeah. What a difference compared to where we were in college with technology to where we are now. The fact that you and I can sit here states apart and talk like we're right next to each other is pretty awesome. Yeah. Back in the day, it was, you know, you look at the weather and you kind of track what was happening in the sky and you would identify features in the sky and then base your movements if you're storm chasing on what you're seeing. There was no radar to look at. Kind of like it now. I have the phone, of course, right next to me, some great apps on my phone to watch the radar and all these products right at our fingertips were kind of spoiled, I guess.
I remember you and I sitting at a baseball game in Davenport and you had just gotten a new cell phone and you were showing me radar on your phone and I was just jawed. I'm like, are you kidding me? Wow.
Yeah. I remember that. The old flip phone.
Yes.
The original flip phones. Okay. Yeah, we've come a long way since then. I mean, that was fascinating technology at the time. And now that looks so antiquated.
It does. But that's, you know, that I think we'd be hip and cool by the kids because we're retro, but that's another story for another
time. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
When I ask about Iowa and Minnesota Minnesota, Wisconsin, all of the Midwest area, you always talked about wanting to work in the South, in the Delta region. What was it about there that attracted you and wanted you to take your skills outside of your comfort zone and a whole different thing of weather that you just didn't know?
I think it goes back to watching hurricanes as a kid. And when Hurricane Andrew hit South Miami, that was in August of 1992, senior in high school. I think you graduated in 93 as well. 94. Okay, yeah, so a year. So I was a senior August of 92 when that storm was coming into Miami. And I remember seeing the pictures and thinking just watching in amazement how powerful that hurricane was as it came in. And then when I was looking at colleges, I did tour the University of Miami. So I was down there with my parents, my brothers, and we saw some of the damage left over from Andrew that was piled up near Homestead. It just roads and just debris everywhere. And I just, you know, a Midwest kid, you see some tornado damage, but you never see damage on that scale. So that kind of stuck with me, and I was fascinated then by hurricanes. You know, how did they form? How did they produce so much damage? And then going through so many years in the Midwest, I just wanted to experience hurricanes, and I got tired of the winters and the snow and the cold and the, you know, breaking the door handles on my car, trying to get it open because it was all frozen shut. So to have the chance to go south to cover hurricanes, experience them, learn more about them, and have really nice winters with palm trees and citrus trees.
Yeah. It's like 35 degrees today and blustery in March. It's miserable, but I'm guessing it's like 70 and sunny.
It's pretty much close to 70 and partly cloudy.
You have to deal with humidity more than we do, right?
We do. Yeah. You know, but I bring this up at least once every summer. You know, people think that humidity here is bad, and it is, because it's relentless from mid-May until late September. But there is nothing more humid than a July afternoon in a cornfield in the Midwest in general, when dew points can hit the 80s, and dew points here, 75, 76, kind of hold there all summer long, sometimes 72, 73. But in the Midwest, you get those periods when the corn is tasseling and the evapotranspiration is crazy. A thunderstorm complex comes in, it's 90 the next day, corn is putting up all this moisture, and dew points can hit 81 to 83. And I did tasseled corn. That was my first, you know, paying job for Pioneer when I was 13 years old. Bus would pick us up in Chadwick, take us to cornfields by Sterling and Rock Falls. And, you know, we'd trudge through these fields pulling the tassels. And there was to this day, I've never experienced anything more miserable than the humidity in a cornfield somewhere in rural Illinois in July.
It is miserable, and it hasn't changed. That has not changed.
Right. But the key is you get breaks. You get these cold fronts to come in, so you get a hot, humid period in the summertime, and there's always a cold front that comes in. We don't get those fronts down here.
In the day we're recording this, earlier in the week, you had some storms come through. And for market to market, we're always looking at the weather in your region. We always end up with a lot of stories in March, April about what happens. Severe season that rolls across Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, into Georgia. We have a lot of viewers down there. We have a lot of cotton country that we know is important in the grand scheme of agriculture and plus the other row crops. But what is it about March that spurs these outbreaks? You talked about the July humidity and the drops that we have. Is your moisture more charged in March?
You know, the thing, it's so weird, because most of the moisture for North America, it comes in from the Gulf of Mexico. So for you in the Midwest, it takes a couple of days for that moisture to come in from the Gulf, kind of come up through Kentucky into Illinois and Iowa. Here, it's just you get a south wind, and within a day, there's the moisture. I mean, the Gulf of Mexico is 70 miles from us, so that moisture comes in very quickly. And then this time of year, these storm systems form on the boundary between the warmer air and the colder air, and that boundary tends to be farther south this time of year. So you get these systems to spin in from the west, they develop over the heart of the country, lift to the northeast, and just draws all that moisture in. So this time of year, like we saw in recent days, a lot of moisture coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, and then a lot of wind energy in the atmosphere. And those two components produce so much severe weather in the south this time of year. It seems like it's relentless. It's just one after another. And every single time, you know, one comes at us, we watch it closely, of course.
What about the numbers of tornadoes, the intensity of them? Are you seeing more EF4s than EF1s? Or, you know, have you looked at any of that?
Yeah. You know, what's weird is there's only been in our National Weather Service county warning area, in our office, main office is Tallahassee, there's only been one EF4 recorded in history, and that was Enterprise, Alabama, back in 2007, March 1st. It was an EF4, hit a high school, 8 students were killed, another person was killed in town, a freak storm. Most of what we see in the Deep South are EF3 or less. Majority of them are EF0, EF1s that are really just brief tornadoes. And it's due a lot to the fact that there's a lot of moisture in the air. And the more moisture there in the air, the lower the cloud base. And a lot of our rotation is very low in the sky. And by low, I mean under 5,000 feet. So these are usually short-lived tornadoes. Maybe just one scan on the radar, you can see that circulation. But they come down, they do some damage, 80, 90, maybe 120 mile per hour winds, and then they lift. The one in New Orleans earlier in the week was rated an EF3, and that's pretty rare to have an EF3 that intensity in the deep South. Now you go farther north, up towards Tuscaloosa and Birmingham and Huntsville and Jackson, Mississippi. Those areas can see EF4s, EF5s, but closer to the Gulf Coast, most of ours are lower end. But there's a lot of them. It seems like every single system we have, there's going to be a couple brief spin-ups that occur. In fact, I think the National Weather Service office in Tallahassee, I think they're number two in the country in recent years for the number of tornado warnings issued. So there's been a bit of a shift in the last, say, 10 years where the prime tornado alley country and the midsection of the country has seen a bit of a lull in activity. And then this area, Mississippi into Alabama in particular, has seen kind of an uptick.
Well, I've kind of watched, you know, I think some of the folks in Birmingham, and you kind of skipped over Tornado Alley, what we, you know, the Oklahoma City, Kansas City, Little Rock, on over to Memphis region, because that's a different area too. But that's where you're saying is maybe some of these things have shifted a little bit farther south, these tornadoes?
Certainly in the last 10 years. Oklahoma and Kansas and Missouri, you think about some of the big ones, more Oklahoma in the early 2000s. Joplin got hit real bad, a lot in Kansas. That area has kind of just shifted to what we call Dixie Alley. So Jackson, Mississippi to Tupelo up towards Tuscaloosa, where the University of Alabama is, and Birmingham. They had, of course, a big outbreak back in 2011, April 27th of 2011. So, yeah, probably just you know, weather and climate work on scales that are variable, and you know, a lot of factors are in play, but not, I guess, unusual to see that shift, and it'll probably shift back at some point where the focus is more on the plain states, but it keeps us hopping for sure.
Well, the topic is always about climate change and weather pattern changes. I mean, we have an Iowa State, a long time, he's now a professor emeritus, talks about that we're just in that 14 to 17 year period where things are more unstable. They might be more stable than completely unstable, and then they're just, well, whatever happens. Are you buying more of a just a, you know, a decadal oscillation, I think is one of the terms?
Yeah, there's a change in the Atlantic currents that impact the water temperature. So that's one oscillation. But there are so many different oscillations at play around the world, and they're always in different phases. So, you know, certain oscillations will link up and produce certain kinds of weather across the globe. And there's so much to learn. I think there's just so much at play. You know, we're learning, you know, things that we've not seen in the past, we're seeing now, and there are things that we've seen in the past that we're not seeing now. So there's always these variations that are occurring. And I think, you know, humans are pretty adaptable. We live all over the earth and we can adapt to all kinds of weather. So I guess that's good. But we have to be careful, I think, in how we manage land, you know, just farmland in particular. That is going to make a difference in the climate, because you're replacing what were trees with now farm fields, and the sun's rays can be absorbed by the dirt that wouldn't be absorbed if there was grass. So there are all kinds of things at play that we have to think about. And I think developing land, especially cities, where does that water go? When there's a runoff, like we were talking about Manly, you know, that potential in Iowa is to get 25 inches in the span of a night or two. I mean, how many places can handle that kind of water? You know, too many parking lots, too much runoff. That water's got to go somewhere, and that can lead to more problems. So I think as a society, we need to think about how we manage weather that we know can happen. Heavy rainfall is a good example of that.
Well, I've been here long enough to cover way too many 100-year floods. I think of 2008, 2011. We just had another one. But I always seem to hear that the hydrologists will tell me that the longer we can keep water in its place before running off and going somewhere, the better off and the less damaging flooding can be. Is that kind of line up with what you were just talking about?
That's it. We need to, you take a big parking lot and all that water falls, normally majority of it would soak into the ground right there. Well, now it can't soak in at all. So all that water is being displaced and it's got to fill up somewhere else. So I think, yeah, the more we can contain water, if it's a neighborhood that's being built and there are retention ponds or detention ponds, that's a good thing, just to hold that water until it can naturally drain. And we've done a lot to the rivers. Well, living in Mississippi too.
Yeah.
You see what the impacts are.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. Let's go back to our time in the Quad Cities. Yeah. Davenport was the one in that area that didn't have the flood wall.
Right.
And there was always the debate. If you remember Phil Yerington sitting on the flood wall, telling on CNN, the mayor of Davenport, we are never going to build a flood wall in this town. He's no longer with us, and there's still no flood wall. But we have temporary barriers that go up.
Right.
What is that done, and how is that studied to look at, and who's going to end up having the final say of flood walls, yes, no, more spread out, back channels? Who's going to have to be at the table for that discussion?
I think every single local government that's along the impact zone needs to have a say in it. I think states have to have a say in it. The fact is, if you build, you think about Rock Island and Moline, you build a levee, that water 200 years ago would cover that whole area. The whole, most of those cities would be covered up. Now you've got these levees and you're constricting that water into a smaller channel. Well, as you do that, kind of like, I don't have a balloon or I have this ball over there, but you squeeze that together, you're going to raise the level. So the more levees that are built and flood containment areas that are built, you just end up, you know, raising that water level for everyone downstream. So we know what someone does up in Dubuque is going to make a difference to what happens in Burlington. There's just going to be a difference. So an impact. There are so many factors and so many variables that have to come together, so many entities that need to come together. You're trying to live too, right? We're trying to develop as a society. So you want to protect some areas from flooding. Farmland, you can't have farmland flood every 3 years. You're not going to be able to grow a crop. There's no point in spending that money, especially with fuel the way it is, if you don't think you can get a crop one out of every 3 years because of flooding. So I don't know. It's a very, very complex issue.
Can you name all the crops on your drive home from the office?
Yeah. Well, no, we have a lot of peanuts down here, which is pretty cool. A lot of peanuts and a lot of cotton, some corn. I get, you know, a little sentimental when I go through some of these areas where I see these cornfields, and it reminds me of being home. There's a spot in Florida on 231, just as you cross into Florida from going south from Dothan, and this farmer plants corn, and it's kind of like rolling hills. It's amazing how many rolling hills are in North Florida. And for this little window on the highway, you think you could be somewhere in Iowa. You look around, it's like, man, not in Florida. I'm in corn country, but yeah, I just, having grown up in a small town in an agricultural area, I feel at home around agriculture and farm fields. The cotton is pretty cool. When you see a cotton crop after the bolls open up and everything's all white, it looks like snow in the field. That's pretty cool.
Well, cotton last year when the bolls opened, you had a whole lot of rain come through.
Yeah.
It kind of caused a big problem. I mean, the cotton market hasn't quite recovered since then. I know that's not the only factor in the market. There's a lot of global pictures. But, you know, which farmer gets the most nervous about weather at the key time? I mean, you've been around the corn farmer, the guy who puts down, or the woman who puts down hay and is trying to bale it. You've got cotton out there. Which farmer gets the most nervous?
Oh man, that's a tough question. When they harvest peanuts, they will turn the peanuts. So they'll basically take that plant, tip it upside down, and then the peanuts will dry. So when they do that, they don't want any rain because you want the peanuts to dry and not get moldy. Corn, of course, if you don't have that rain in June, when that crop is trying to develop into July, forget about it. You're not going to form any big ears. You're not going to have your kernels fill out. So that's a stressful time. Cotton, you think about hurricane season, and once those bolls open up, if there's a bunch of rain or wind that saturate that field and then knock down that cotton, then you're not going to be able to pick as much of it, and the quality is going to be poor. So it seems like they're all even. They each have issues. And of course, with hay, you better know you have a 4-day window. If you're going to cut that hay and get ready to bale it, you don't want same thing, rain on top of that. So different issues at different times of year for all the farmers. I mean, I love growing things. I still garden a bunch right now. And me dealing with my little gardens is a headache. I can't imagine what farmers go through day in and day out. There's just so much to consider.
Is there a farm region that contacted you more than another? The farmers somewhere, like, did the farmers in North Iowa, like, hey, David, I got to do this, or the ones in Kirksville or Louisiana, the shipping captains or something?
Probably the ones at bale hay is probably the most important that I've seen more contact from over my career are those that are baling hay, and that they really need that window to cut and bale, and they really want to know rain chances. So out of everything I've experienced as far as farming, I think the hay has been the big one that people really, you know, they really want that window of dry weather.
Do you notice anything different about farmers from region to region? I usually ask this people who've been in various parts of the country, and you can accurately kind of compare some things. But what's the difference in regions with a farmer?
I was so well connected for a while in Northwest Illinois to farmers. And, you know, I had a girlfriend in Albany, Georgia, and I was with her dad a lot. And we'd go to one of the local restaurants for lunch. And I helped him out a lot on the farm, did some chisel plowing and help with combining. But I'd go with him to this small diner and just with these old time farmers, sit with them and talk. And that was fascinating to me. I've never experienced that as I did in the Midwest. So that was really cool. You know, I think there's been changes that you and I have seen in the last 25 years of these small farmers kind of going away and these bigger conglomerates kind of taking over, where I don't know if you have as much, you know, local relationships like you had back in the day. I think the crops are different. It seems like corn and soybean farmers, you know, I think maybe they monitor more often, because with a peanut crop, you put it in the ground and it is what it is until
you can't see it.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's doing its thing, right? And same thing with cotton. I mean, you put it in, you're not as worried. And the rain down here is usually, you know, pretty constant. I mean, you're going to get thunderstorms all summer long, so you're not really worried about, you know, are we getting enough rain? But in the Midwest, I think there's just more day-to-day interest in weather, I think, from the farmers up there, because it's variable. I mean, you can go through years, you know, we're super dry, and then years where it's super wet, and too much rain in May, June can flood out fields, or maybe have a late freeze into early to mid-May or wet April, and you can't plant on time. And then your window, you know, your harvest, when your growing season window is only so many days, you've got to get those crops in. And then you have a flood in mid-May, or a freak frost in mid-May, do you replant? Do you take that chance and risk an early frost in September? Do you, you know, I think there's just more headaches in the Midwest in general. And I think the farmers therefore are a little more, you know, in tune to the weather.
I know we're butting up against you getting to your real job. I have to ask two questions. Yeah. The first is, the drought monitor comes out on Thursdays. I always look at that. The level 2 weeks ago was the highest we'd seen since 2012, 75% of the contiguous U.S. in some form of drought. We're still dealing La Nina issues. How big of a story is weather going to be for the majority of the country on the dry side this year?
Looking at a lot of the long-range computer models, it looks like as we go through the summertime that there are going to be some dry areas, especially the northern part of the country, that persists probably all summer long. So I think that will be more and more of an issue. Y'all didn't see much snow up there either, you know, compared to what you normally see.
Correct.
So, yeah, you didn't have that moisture recharge over the winter. And we were kind of the same way down here. Now, we've had a lot of rainfall in the last couple of weeks, which has helped. But I think that will be an issue as we go through the summertime, the growing season, the lack of moisture. And it's odd because a couple of years ago, most of the country was perfectly fine on moisture. Now this phase that we're in now is dry. So, yeah, that's something to watch, I think. You know, temperatures are going to vary, of course, but that lack of rainfall coming off a drier winter, that lack of rainfall potential in the summertime could be a bigger story for the main growing region in the country up north there.
Last question. The Cubs going to win the Central?
No.
Who is?
Probably the Cardinals.
No. The Cardinals didn't do anything.
Well, they don't have to. They've got.
We just underperformed last year.
You got pitching, and that's something the Cubs. You know, I don't know.
Back of the bullpen is still a challenge, but.
Yeah, but the Pirates aren't doing anything. The Reds aren't doing anything, certainly.
Still the Brewers. I still think it's the Brewers.
Yeah, I think Brewers and Cubs will be middle. I think as much as they don't want to admit it, I think the Cardinals have the best chance to win that division. What do you think?
I think it is going to be Cubs-Cards. I think it's going to be 1-2. I think the Brewers actually are going to fall off. I think they've maybe headed in the wrong direction. I'm a little concerned about some of the things in St. Louis, but we'll see. I'll get to see your AAA team here soon. We open up the season in just a couple of weeks, so I'll get to see those baby Cubs before they head to Chicago for you. I'll let you know how the crop's looking there.
That's good. Who knows with the Cubs this season? Last year was kind of weird. A lot of those, you know, AAA guys ended up in the big leagues there once summertime rolled around, and we'll see how many can stick this year up there.
Well, we'll get to we get to truly see how good of a manager David Ross is this
That's
year.
That's right.
I think he we're finally going to see that. David Paul is the chief meteorologist, WTVY in Dothan, Alabama. Good to see you, friend. Thank you so much for doing
this.
Paul,
great seeing you. Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for this installment of the MTOM Show podcast. We're on again next Tuesday where these new episodes drop wherever you get the podcasts, on Apple or YouTube. Send me an email, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next time.